Since it is the middle of the beach season, we thought it a good time to talk to a man who's been writing about Florida for almost three decades. Carl Hiaasen, author of 11 novels and a long-running column in the Miami Herald, has a new novel set in his home state. In Star Island, he creates his usual collection of oddball characters, including a vacuous pop singer and her double, the hygiene-challenged freelance photographer who stalks her, corrupt land developers, and yes, there's even an altruistic, if flawed, hero. Mr. Hiaasen, welcome to the show.
Good to be back.
So tell us about the title, Star Island.
Well, Star Island is an actual place in Miami Beach, and a lot of celebrities live there. It's an island in Biscayne Bay between the mainland and South Beach. And it's also sort of a double meaning because the star, this young singer, is isolated and detached in a way that she might as well be on an island. She's not very connected to reality anymore.
You called her a singer. Her name is Cherry Pie.
That's her stage name that her thoughtful mother dreamed up. And she's one of these, you see them every day if you watch Inside Hollywood or Hollywood Access or Access Inside or whatever those shows are called. I mean, there's just a parade of them, and they become faceless after a while. But it's part of the machinery. You know, we crank out these celebrities and wait for them to implode.
So safe to say she's a wreck.
She's a complete train wreck.
All with questionable talent.
I was like, no talent. No talent whatsoever.
Okay.
But that's what part of the book is partly about, is this. America has always been fascinated by celebrities. Oh, let's listen to Mel Gibson's latest rant, or let's look at some video of Lindsay Lohan melting down in the courtroom. I understand that as a fleeting sort of diversion. What I don't understand is the obsession that has generated this huge industry. And the amount of resources and time and talented people who are devoted to chasing celebrities around when there are a lot more important things going on in the world. So that's some of what's being lampooned in this novel.
So let's get to the other lead character, a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist named Bang Abbott.
Yes.
A tainted Pulitzer.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, novelists are attracted. We're drawn to sort of lowlifes and bottom feeders. They're such interesting characters, and they're fun to write about, and they're fun to bring to life on the page. And I've been wanting to write about a paparazzo for a long time. The industry now is bigger than ever. The industry of chasing celebrities around is huge in this country. The money's to be made is big. And so I wanted a character like that in the book. And so he is the villain, and he's also, you know, for me as a writer, fun to write.
Early in the book, you take us into his world by giving us a glimpse of his BlackBerry, which is probably his best friend in the entire world, this BlackBerry.
Yes.
Page 32.
All right. As soon as he walked off the flight from Miami, he checked his BlackBerry for overnight messages. A valet from the peninsula had called to say Katie Holmes was table dancing in the bar. Next, a dry cleaner in Westwood had phoned to say Johnny Depp had personally dropped off a cummerbund for laundering. Then a waitress at Hugo's had breathlessly reported an unpleasant encounter with Star Jones involving a decaf triple latte. Only the Katie sighting sparked any interest from Bang Abbott, and he suspected the tip wasn't true. The source was so hopelessly nearsighted that he'd once mistaken Lyle Lovett for Angelica Houston.
So these are all tips from people.
Tips.
He bribes, he pays them.
Yeah, he corrupts them and co-opts them in any way possible, because information is the coin of the realm. Who's staying at that hotel? Who's he with? Is he, you know, I mean, they live and breathe on rumor and gossip, and Bang is right in the middle of it.
You bring back a recurring character from several of your earlier books, the former governor of Florida. Your loyal readers know him as Clinton Tyree.
Yeah, he goes by the nickname of Skink, and he's a character that I get more mail and more questions about than any other. He was governor very briefly of Florida. He was actually honest and incorruptible, and therefore he didn't last very long at all in Tallahassee. He went completely stark, raving nuts, and tore his clothes off and disappeared into the mangroves. I'd always had a fantasy of turning Skink loose on South Beach, one of the more pretentious, silly places you could go. And colorful and interesting, but nonetheless, it would be such a collision of values that I thought I've got to find a way to get him to South Beach. And so this story seemed like a good way to do it.
There's a passage where you give us kind of the backstory on Skink.
Right. The cherished wild places of his childhood had vanished under cinder blocks and asphalt, and so too had the rest of the state been transformed, hijacked by greedy suckworms disguised as upright citizens. From swampy lairs, Skink would strike back whenever an opportunity arose, and the message was never ambiguous.
Is Skink your alter ego in this book? Is he what you might be if you were just a totally deranged madman?
I mean, if I was a total... I've said in the past, I mean, in every novel there are characters who I think say and do things that I wish I could say and do and get away with. And he certainly shares my political views of what's happened to Florida, and I think he certainly shares my views about the shallowness of the culture. But I don't know that he's an alter ego. I mean, I think in some ways he's more grounded than I am.
Well, as a writer of satire, how do you stay ahead of the curve when reality is giving us Lindsay Lohan and Levi?
It's so hard to do it. I mean, I every day I read the paper, and I, you know, if you think you've written a passage that has really reached some new height or depth of depravity, and you pick up, especially the Miami Herald, there's a headline in there every day that just you slap your head and you say, you know, I can't get ahead of the curve because the reality is too weird. I mean, all you could do is try and then hope that it doesn't, whatever you write, doesn't come to pass between now and the day that it's published.
We've been talking to Carl Hyacin. His new book is called Star Island. He joined us from Bozeman, Montana. Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot, Don. It was great talking to you again.
And you can read about the lengths one paparazzo will go for a photo of the famous cherry pie, spelled P-Y-E. It's on our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. People who kept their dial tuned to AMC after the season finale of Breaking Bad and the season premiere of Mad Men may have been surprised to see a sneak preview of AMC's new original series. It's called Rubicon, and it's a modern-day spy thriller. On Sunday, AMC presents the first 2 hours of Rubicon, and our TV critic David Bianculli considers it a triumph.
Before I describe what Rubicon is, let me make clear what it isn't. It isn't the kind of show you can watch while multitasking and hope to make any sense of it, much less enjoy it. You have to pay attention. And even then, many of the things you're looking at won't be clear at first. But that doesn't only relate to the show. It's also what the show is about. And that's why, if you give it a chance, Rubicon will earn its way onto your have-to-watch list. Rubicon is a drama series about the workaday analyst at a fictional present-day American spy agency called the American Policy Institute, API for short. The API is a sort of central clearinghouse for intelligence gathering, a way to make sense of all the conversations, observations, and evidence collected by the FBI, CIA, and others. Every night, these agencies pass on their findings to the API. And the API's job is to sift through the piles, detect patterns, and connect all the dots. Other spies get to drive the Aston Martins and bed enemy agents. These guys, back in a nondescript New York office building, do all the drudge work and the really serious thinking. But they all have complicated, messed-up personal lives. And in what's probably an occupational hazard, they have a lot of trust issues, too. With good reason. Some of the co-workers are spying on each other. And, as Rubicon begins, more than one high-level spy suddenly dies. This spy versus spy stuff has echoes of ABC's Alias, but its true TV ancestor is the fabulous British miniseries Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. It isn't the action that gets you. It's the suspense, the suspicion, the paranoia. Except it's not paranoia if they really are out to get you. And in Rubicon, they are. The central character in Rubicon is Will Travers, a brilliant intelligence analyst with a tragic past and with one true friend at the agency, his boss, David. Will is played by James Badge Dale, last seen as Lecky in the HBO miniseries The Pacific. David is played by Peter Garrity, that fabulous character actor from Homicide: Life on the Street, The Wire, and elsewhere. Will is comfortable enough to come to David with anything, even something as seemingly random as an odd pattern he finds in crossword puzzles published by different newspapers the same day. The clues in those puzzles aren't the same, but in a few select instances, the answers are.
David, I think I found a pattern in the big ticket papers. There might be others, I'm not sure, but it's not just the repetition. Three down, two chambers of the legislative branch, bicameral, simple enough. Two across, Fillmore, where the Warlocks, later known as the Grateful Dead, played in San Francisco, but also Millard Fillmore, lard-ass know-nothing 13th president, the executive. Four down, would-be alma mater of felonious record-holding wide receiver. Answer, Marshall, as in Randy Moss, Marshall University Thundering Herd, but also Thurgood Marshall, judicial. Five down, what do lucky lepidopter larvae eat? Answer, Marsilia quadrifolia.
Which is?
Four-leaf clover. Our three branches of government are here. Legislative, executive, judicial. What or who does that fourth leaf represent? And what's the message?
Like I said, these guys are smart. And so is Rubicon. Jason Horwich, who wrote a clever FX telemovie about the Pentagon Papers, created the show. And its executive producer is writer-director Henry Brummell. I never really got Brummell's Carnival series for HBO, but I've loved lots of the other stuff on which he's worked, including Homicide and Northern Exposure. The creators of this new TV series are upfront about being inspired by some of the greatest conspiracy thriller movies of the 1970s, All the President's Men, 3 Days of the Condor, and that underrated classic, The Parallax View. But Rubicon isn't just an homage, it's a much-needed update. In an era when we're all being watched one way or another, the question, who's watching the watchers, becomes even more vital. The more time you spend with the watchers at API, the more fragile they are, and the more fascinating. Lauren Hodges from In Treatment plays one of Will's co-workers, and the widow of one of the early fatalities is played by Miranda Richardson. I've seen the first 4 episodes of Rubicon, and each one is a little more frightening and mind-blowing. Episode 2 is the one that hooks you, so you have to be a little patient. But after that, I doubt you'll ever look at crossword puzzles or four-leaf clovers the same way again.
David Bianculli is TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University in New Jersey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
NPR's business news starts with Google building its own Facebook. Google is reportedly developing a social networking site that could rival Facebook. Today, the Wall Street Journal reports that Google has been talking to companies that make social networking games. Games like Farmville, which is played within Facebook, draw tens of millions of players a month. They're also potentially lucrative for the sites that host them. Earlier this year, Google unveiled a networking service called Buzz, but critics complained about privacy concerns. This could be the company's second try, though today's report gives no details on when Google might launch the new offering.
Last night, the stars came out in the sleepy town of Rhinebeck, New York, for one of the most anticipated weddings of the summer season. Chelsea Clinton, the 30-year-old daughter of former President Bill Clinton and current Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, exchanged vows with Mark Mezvinsky, her longtime boyfriend, whose parents served as members of Congress. Amid tight security, the Jewish Methodist sunset service and evening of dinner and dancing unfolded at Astor Courts, a secluded estate on the Hudson River. The bride wore a strapless white gown and a radiant smile. You're listening to NPR News.